watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Our petrochemical lifestyle has poisoned the air, water, and soil, and is now changing the Earth's climate pattern toward an ecosystem that predates the circumstances under which we and the animals and plants on which we interdepend have evolved. Our agriculture, which made an exponential expansion of human population possible, is based in Earth's temperate zones, which will be drastically reduced as the planet heats up. Much of Earth's arable soil has already been damaged by industrial agriculture. All over the industrialized world, people are gathering to discuss and implement projects for sustainability, conservation, and relocalization. Individuals trying to change their lifestyles can only go so far. The problems are systemic and require a shift in the widespread practices of industrial societies and the fundamental concepts upon which they are based, such as economic growth, globalized production, and the natural world as property and resource. Our laws and courts are not geared to deal with the scale of ecological harm, which once caused often can't be restored within a human timescale. It is irreparable harm. People attempting to address our ecological problems find the laws inadequate, if not downright hostile. Activists find themselves in jail for trying to stop harmful activity, while the perpetrators receive the protection of the state. Legal practitioners and communities confronted by this legal brick wall are working to establish new law that will conform to our ecological reality. They call it Earth jurisprudence. This week, we'll begin a three-part series focusing on the theory and actions of this movement for the rights of nature under law and how communities are using it to fight corporate destruction. One such initiative has been the founding in 2006 of the First Center for Earth Jurisprudence, a joint project of two Florida law schools, St. Thomas University in Miami and Barry University in Orlando. Their first symposium was held in February 2007. Their second was held on February 29th and brought together panels of top speakers on law, environment, and ethics. The material for our series is drawn from those symposia. Cormac Cullinan, a South African environmental lawyer, is one of the pioneering legal theorists of the rights of nature. He coined the term wild law to refer to human laws that are consistent with an earth jurisprudence, which he laid out in his 2002 book, Wild Law, A Manifesto for Earth Justice. One of its inspirations was a conference in Washington, D.C. in 2001, keynoted by the environmentalist theologian Thomas Berry and organized by the Gaia Foundation. A group of people involved with law and indigenous people's rights attended from South Africa, Britain, Colombia, Canada, and the United States. Cullinan began his book, Wild Law, with these words: "I know that wild law sounds like nonsense, a contradiction in terms. Law, after all, is intended to bind, constrain, regularize, and civilize. Law's rules, backed up by force, are designed to clip prune and train the wilderness of human behavior into the manicured lawns and shrubbery of the civilized garden. Wild, on the other hand, is synonymous with unkempt, barbarous, unrefined, uncivilized, unrestrained, wayward, disorderly, irregular, out of control, unconventional, undisciplined, passionate, violent, uncultivated, and riotous. In fact, the Wild West of North America was described as wild, specifically because of the general lawlessness that prevailed there. It is precisely the rigidity of this false dichotomy between the wild and law, between nature and civilization, that we need to overcome. Here's Cormac Cullinan, author of Wild Law, speaking at the 2007 symposium at the Center for Earth Jurisprudence.
Good morning, everybody. I'd like to start by saying what an honor it is for me to be here. I feel that this is a very significant moment for me. Earth jurisprudence is very close to my heart, and I hope it will be a moment which will be significant for everybody here, and perhaps in future years we'll look back and say that this was a milestone which had significance for people beyond this room, and not only people, I hope, but also other members of our Earth community. It's also wonderful to hear the rain. Where I come from in Africa, rain is always understood as a blessing. So I hope that that the elements are concurring with us today and blessing this event. It's only 6 short years, almost to the day, since I came to the United States to meet Thomas Berry. Liz Hoskins, who will hear speak later, and Ed Posey of the Gaia Foundation, had come across me in Cape Town and invited me to a meeting that was being organized to take up the challenge posed by Thomas Berry, which was to develop a new jurisprudence. Thomas had produced a one-page document called The Origin, Differentiation, and Role of Rights, which set out 10 points which he thought should be taken into account and used as a guide for rethinking our entire approach to law and governance. And he focused particularly on the legal and political regimes because he felt that they were not only critical in determining human behavior, and let's face it, we need some very substantial changes in human behavior if our planet is not going to be completely devastated, but also because of the fact that he saw law as being an obstacle to moving to what he saw as he described as the Ecozoic age. Now, I can still remember us convening, and by that stage, myself and others had began to refer to this as an Earth jurisprudence, as a kind of tentative name. And on the first day, we broke at lunchtime and we went into the eating hall at the Ailey Center where we were meeting. And there were a couple of tables reserved for our group. And on each table, there was a small piece of cardboard bent over, and it said, Earth jurisprudence. I've still got one of those pieces of cardboard because it was a moment for me in which it became real. I thought, well, it's got to be real now. We were just an idea, but now the table's reserved for it, so it's got to be real. But I must say, 6 years later, to be standing at the world's first Earth Jurisprudence Center, located in two law schools, is quite amazing. For me, that is a very significant step down the road, and I'm sure this center will prove to will play a very leading role in the development of this field in the future. Now, in the short time available to me now, I can't give you an in-depth understanding of what I mean by Earth jurisprudence, and I presume that very few people here would have read Wild Law, which sets out the ideas. So I'm only going to attempt to give you a brief understanding of what we're talking about, and leave it up to you to ask further questions if you want to more detail. Essentially, I'm just wanting to communicate 3 basic points to you this morning. The first is that the generation now living and the few generations that will follow us will see an absolutely unprecedented change in the planet. By unprecedented, I mean unprecedented since human beings have existed as such on this planet. So the point here is a magnitude issue. We're talking about really, really big change and a very, very significant transition. Secondly, I would like to try and communicate why I think that earth jurisprudence will be essential to the future flourishing of humankind. In other words, why we need this at all. And thirdly, to give you some sense that earth jurisprudence is real, practical, happening, and if you choose, you too can be part of making it happen and be part of what I feel is will be a momentous change in our civilizations over the next few decades and perhaps longer. So turning first to the question of magnitude, how big is this? Well, it's the story of the Earth is a very long story, and it's told very eloquently in a book called The Universe Story, written by Thomas Berry and Brian Swim. And it's a story which has been told in many languages. It's a story which is told essentially in creation stories in various religious disciplines. It's also told in scientific language. And I'm not too concerned about the particular mode that one uses to describe the story, but I'll use this primarily scientific language. Essentially, as far as we know, for some mysterious reason, out of the void came the Big Bang, and there was this huge explosion which sent energy and matter rocketing out into the void. And gradually over time, something amazing happened. That seemingly random movement of energy began to organize itself, and a process of creativity was set in motion which continues to this day. So the stars formed, and one of the stars that formed was a huge star called Tiamat, and Tiamat eventually went supernova and created elements and matter which were eventually spun into our solar system with the planets around it. And one of those planets, Earth, was particularly significant, and we have yet to find a planet as unique and special as Earth in the universe. And through a combination of factors to do with the size of Earth, its proximity to the sun, etc., it was possible for one to have gases, liquids and solids coexisting. You had the formation of the oceans, the continents forming, and out of this sort of chemical soup, life emerged. And that life diversified steadily and grew in complexity. From time to time, it had major setbacks, and there were periods of mass extinction, and five, in fact, so far. And unfortunately, we're now in the early stages of the sixth period of mass extinction, the last being 15 million years ago, which saw, we think, the demise of the dinosaurs. But the difference now is that two points, I think, are central to this. The one is we are absolutely part of this Earth story. There is no question of human beings being separate from the system which has given rise to us. Every part of us is shaped by this evolutionary process. If gravity on Earth was slightly different, our limbs would be different. We are nourished by other members of the community. Everything we eat comes from another member of the community, plants, animals, etc. Our minds and our understandings are shaped by by the beauty of the universe, the magnitude of the universe, our experiences. We are quintessentially earthlings. We are, if you like, more a manifestation, a particular form of this earth, or if you like, of the spirit or creative force that lies behind the earth, than something which is entirely separate. Now we found ourselves in a situation where the great transformations which have occurred previously have been the result of natural forces. But now our ability as a single species to transform this Earth has become so powerful and so extensive that we are effectively playing the role of a force of nature. So, for example, while the evolution of species for millennia has been determined by a natural selection, we believe, now whether or not a species lives or dies is not really going to be up to natural selection. It's pretty much dependent on human decision-making. So with that, and we are changing the composition of the Earth. We're changing the basic life support structures and the functioning of those processes. And with that enormous power should come a concomitant responsibility to use that power wisely. But the fact is, like it or not, we are now, the Earth is in a process of radical change. We know about climate change, but in many other areas as well, particularly extinctions. The rate of extinctions now, anthropogenic human-caused extinctions, hasn't been seen for 15 million years since we think a meteorite smashed into the Earth. And we are now in the early stages of that period of extinction. So it's very hard to overestimate, to overstate the magnitude of the change that we're talking about. And I was very fortunate to have been at university, at college in South Africa in the 1980s when the struggle against apartheid was at the forefront and a lot of student activity was directed to that. And the overthrow of apartheid is, I think, a very significant event. It's significant in historical terms. It's significant perhaps on a scale of a century, maybe a few centuries. But what we're talking about here is much, much bigger than that. We're talking about something, a transition, which is significant on the scale of millions of years. So, point one is very big. The second point I want to address is why would we need something like Earth jurisprudence? Well, I think what we call the environmental crisis is really a symptom of a failure of human governance systems. In fact, it's a catastrophic failure of our governance systems, because clearly for any species to consume and destroy its habitat is not a smart thing to do. So the fact that we are doing that, to me, is a clear indication that our self-regulatory mechanisms are malfunctioning. So despite the fact that you've seen an amazing proliferation of environmental law, both at the national level and at the international level in the past few decades, the environment is deteriorating. In short, it's not working. So the feedback we're getting from the way we're going is it's not good enough and it's not working. So as far as I'm concerned, it's not a question of whether we change or not. Change is necessary and inevitable. The question is the direction of the change and how we're going to change. And as somebody who's worked in environmental law for a long time and who I always thought I was kind of one of the good guys, it was a real shock to me to first hear Thomas Berry talk about the fact that our legal systems as a whole legitimate, facilitate, and perpetuate the destruction of the earth on which our human well-being depends. In other words, to hear that law is part of the problem, our whole legal systems is part of the problem, was quite a shock to me. And although I had already been heading in that direction because I kept encountering problems which I couldn't fix by changing legislation, in other words, there were conceptual problems which lay below this at a level of philosophy or the understanding of law which needed to be addressed and which couldn't simply be addressed within the constraints of the current system. And so how did we get into a situation where our legal systems actually support the destruction of our habitat and the system of which we are part? Well, I don't have time to go through the details of it, but essentially I think that you can say that part of it is rooted in a culture which is very attached to two delusions. The one is the delusion that we are separate from the rest of the world. And the reason for mentioning briefly the process, which the evolutionary process or the process of development of the universe which gave rise to human beings is to suggest to you that it's really completely delusional to understand the human being in any way other than as a part of this whole. Every time you draw a breath, you are intimately connected with and part of the whole system. And what makes this delusion of separation particularly problematic is it's coupled with a belief in superiority. So that the working together, the belief is that the rest of the universe is a whole pile of resources, natural resources, which exist for the exclusive purpose of supporting humans. So in other words, we believe, the dominant cultures are based on the belief that the way to increase human well-being is through material possessions, etc. And the way to do that is by taking that away from the earth, essentially exploiting the earth. So you have a situation where, for example, you have GDP growth and your economy may be growing, but at the same time you have a deterioration in the output of the earth. That you're losing topsoil, you're losing fish stocks, you're losing everything which provides the basis for continuing to support human life and other life. So this has been achieved, or this has come about to some extent because of 16th and 17th century ideas of people like Bacon, Descartes, and Newton, who essentially understood the world as a vast machine, a very mechanistic understanding of the world, and which placed a great emphasis on the difference between mind and matter, if you like, a spirit and the material world. And what has since happened, of course, is that science has moved on an awful lot since Newtonian days, and scientists don't understand the world like that anymore. What we now understand is that this is not a big machine made of cogs, and you just need to study each cog to understand how it works. What we're talking about here what's important is the relationship between the bits. So the world or the universe is better understood as a kind of vast, whirling, celebratory dance. Because the thing about a dance is not the dancer, it's not the music, it's not even the steps. The dance is the relationship between all of them. And that gives one perhaps a better sense of how the world functions. And also we are inherent participants in the dance. You know, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle point demonstrated that as soon as one asks a question and one's trying to find something, the act of asking that question, whether it's a speed or mass of an electron, influences the result. So we are an integral part of this whole system. But unfortunately, our legal systems are still based on this mechanistic understanding of the world where there are human beings which are the subjects and everything else is defined as an object. And an object is clearly, by definition, incapable of holding rights. Also, if one thinks of the situation where some people were once defined as objects, in other words, as slaves, one can clearly see that it's not possible to have a healthy relationship between a slave owner and a slave. That relationship is inherently exploitative by virtue of the legal position of the slave, which is viewed as an object owned by the slave owner and incapable of having rights. And yet that is precisely the relationship that we have established in relation to the rest of the world. We have become completely autistic in relation to the natural world. If in law schools, any law school that I've been in, everything you needed to know was in the law library. There was nothing higher than the Constitution. There was no need at all to refer to anything in the natural world. The concept of human beings being part of a wider sense of natural order, of us being a subcomponent of a great system of order in the universe, has been lost. So what are we going to do about it? What can we do about it? Well, I think the first thing one has to do is to define a new purpose or direction for our governance systems. In other words, what we need to say is our governance systems, and by that I mean the whole system which we use to regulate human activity, some of which is law, some of which is policy, some of which is institutional arrangement and enforcement mechanisms, etc. We need to reorientate our whole governance systems towards a new purpose, a purpose to govern ourselves as if we are part of a greater community of life on this earth, which, quite frankly, I think is the factual truth. So in other words, what I'm suggesting is we need to abandon the delusions of separation and superiority and get to grips with the reality that we're part of a community and that we can only be fulfilled as human beings if that community is healthy. If I can use the analogy of a body, if one is a cell in the body, a cell, let's say a liver cell, has to regulate itself in a way which it ensures it functions well as a liver cell. But that liver cell must also contribute to the health of the liver. And the liver itself must contribute to the health of the body as a whole. If that liver cell starts operating in a way which is destructive of the liver and ultimately the body, it effectively becomes a kind of a cancer. And either it will destroy the system or the system must destroy it. So we've forgotten that we're part of a liver. We've forgotten we're part of a body. And we need to reorientate our governance systems towards playing a mutually enhancing role within that wider community. We then need to develop new legal philosophies, what we're calling earth jurisprudence, to explain why, to set out the rationale for doing this and to develop new concepts that support it. And then we need to develop laws, which I refer to as wild laws, which reflect and give effect to that. So the step one is understand and fit in with the greater system, the macro system. This is what I've referred to as the great jurisprudence. Essentially, there's certain basic rules about how the universe functions, which are givens. That is how it is. It's not a question of right or wrong. They're not subject to debate. They cannot be changed by legislation. Something like gravity, that just is. So these are it's essential that we understand the basics of how the universe works. And if you like, this universe, the great jurisprudence, that which is, provides the design parameters for then developing earth jurisprudences. So step two is to work within the natural order and to develop philosophies and understandings of human governance systems which are consistent with the greater order. And what we're concerned with here is justice, for example, rethinking the concept of justice, so that justice doesn't just mean justice for human beings. Justice means justice for all the members of the community and all the members of the community having rights. When we talk about antisocial conduct and we criminalize it, it must be, we must include activities which are antisocial vis-a-vis the whole community and not just in relation to human communities. And then step three is to develop and apply wild laws. Now this, I know, sounds like nonsense. The idea that putting wild and law next to each other sounds nonsensical and crazy. And it's precisely, I think, because our laws have been designed to stamp that out. Because wildness can be understood, if you like, as a metaphor for those natural, creative, vital forces of the universe which have flowed through the universe and made it what it is today. Wildness is very much associated with creativity and passion. And what I'm talking about here is laws which encourage and enhance the connection between humans and the rest of the Earth community. So wildness, in a sense, can be seen as that golden thread which runs through the heart of everybody, connecting human nature with nature out there. It's that link which makes us part of the whole, and it's that vital quality which we deny so much in our legal systems, which are oriented towards conformity, to homogenization, which work against the diversity of the universe. And I just want to add one point here, is that I think it's important to appreciate from the outset that when we're talking about Earth jurisprudence, we're not just talking about something in the outside world. This is not just, it's not only about reforming legal systems, etc. There is an internal dimension. This is about reorientating ourselves and reintegrating ourselves into the community. In the same way as white South Africans were born into a position of privilege and born into the role of the oppressors, and that oppression diminished them as people. They, as the oppressors, could not be fully human while one was exploiting other people. In the same way, as for South African society to flourish and for the new South Africa to go ahead, and even for white South Africans to be fully human, it was necessary to recognize the rights of others. It was necessary to give up the illusions that you could be separate from the rest of your community and that you were superior to the rest of your community. We as human beings, our species is also born into that role of the oppressor in the current cultures in which most of us live. And if we are to be truly human, if we are to regain the benefits of being an integral part of a community within which we can be fulfilled, not just materially, but also psychologically, spiritually, etc., then we too must recognize the rights of the other members of the community. So the question which is often put to me is, well, how practical is all of this? Sure, it's great ideas, but they're a bit sort of pie in the sky, etc., and, you know, the reality is that we live in a world which is dominated by powerful corporations and wealthy people, etc. Always reminds me of a cartoon that I saw once, and it was a whole lot of representatives of the oil industry briefing the president, I think the president of the United States. And they were in the Oval Office, and they had all their graphs there, etc. And one of them saying to the president, well, in conclusion, Mr. President, as you can see, the survival of the human species just doesn't make economic sense. And I think that's kind of where we're at, is that the point is, when we're talking about how practical and viable this is, the one thing that we do know is the road that we're on is not viable and not practical. So when we talk about development, when we talk about progress, I mean, if you're making progress towards a cliff, well, maybe progress is not such a good thing to be doing. And the key thing when you're heading towards a cliff is not just to slow down, it's to change direction. So we're in a situation where we've got this whole worldview, which is basically believing that you can have endless development in a form which involves destruction of the Earth system on which we depend. We believe that progress is attempting to achieve infinitely increasing gross domestic product, even though at the same time we're destroying the Earth. Now nobody believes it. I mean, sorry, if one stops for a moment, one can see one can't have GDP that goes up and up forever when it's being achieved at the cost of destroying the planet. So the point really is that if one looks at the existing system, if one looks at the presumptions and the understandings which underlie our legal systems, that everything is objects for us to exploit, the fact is this emperor has got no clothes. We're all going along with a whole lot of delusions and fallacies, which if we stop for a moment to think, we can see quite clearly are not true. They're not in accordance with science. They're not in accordance with any of the great wisdom traditions that different human cultures have developed. So although from the perspective of living in a corporate-dominated culture where materialism is rampant, these ideas may seem very strange, one must realize that if one looks at the vast sweep of human history, the period in which we live is more of an aberration. For the vast majority of human existence, we've understood, indigenous people and tribal peoples always understood that they were part of a wider system that they needed to respect and conform with. The ideas that we can exist separately from the earth are relatively recent. So in conclusion, then, I'd just like to say that, to reiterate that I think that the challenge, we face an enormous challenge, but it's an incredibly exciting period to be alive on, to be living on Earth, because for whatever reason, all of us have been born into this time of enormous transition where there is an awful lot of at stake. And what we require, I think, in relation to the law is a shift of Copernican magnitude. By that I mean, you know, Copernicus said, hang on, despite what everybody's saying, it seems to me that the Earth is going around the sun, not the other way around. Now, the interesting thing is that the authorities rejected what Copernicus said, and Galileo subsequently said. He didn't win over the authorities at the time, but he put in place a view of the world, an alternative view, if you like, which people gradually defected to. And nowadays, you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody who believes that the sun moves around the Earth. Now, the point is, and why there was such resistance to Copernicus's ideas, was because it challenged humans' ideas of themselves at the center of the universe, and human beings being the most important. So although we've accepted now that perhaps in a literal sense the rest of the universe doesn't revolve around us, or the rest of the solar system doesn't revolve around us, actually we've still held on to the fact that we are the most important. We are, that in a sense, the rest of the world and the universe exists for us. Now, what we're talking about here is changing the purpose of our legal systems to recognize that we exist within a context, to fit in with that context, and to enable us to play a role as good Earth citizens within this Earth community. So the project that we're talking about is about restoring integrity to law and society. And by integrity, I mean the real meaning of it as to make whole again, to create a sense of consistency between the context that we are born into and how we live our lives. So at the risk of sounding melodramatic, I'd like to end by paraphrasing a famous American, and particularly to those of you who are at the cusp of going out into the world and beginning legal careers. I think what we need to do is ask not how best you can use and exploit the earth, but what you can do for your Earth community. Thank you.
South African environmental lawyer Cormac Cullinan, author of Wild Law, speaking at the first symposium of the Center for Earth Jurisprudence in 2007. The next speaker from that symposium is well known to longtime listeners of this show. He's Tom Lindsay of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDEF, in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, which has been helping local communities fight environmentally damaging corporate incursions through democracy schools that help communities to organize to pass local laws that challenge corporate rights and personhood. On March 15th, the town of Nottingham, New Hampshire, passed the Nottingham Water Rights and Local Self-Government Ordinance at their town meeting. The ordinance establishes strict liability for culpable corporations and government entities that permit and facilitate the privatization and corporatization of water within the town. The ordinance also strips corporations of constitutional protections within the town. The town of Nottingham becomes the 11th municipality in the nation to refuse to recognize corporate constitutional rights and to prohibit corporate rights from being used to override the rights of human and natural communities. At a town meeting the same day in Barnstead, New Hampshire, voters amended their water rights ordinance, which had passed almost unanimously at a town meeting 2 years earlier, to include the rights of nature. Barnstead, New Hampshire became the 12th municipality in the nation to recognize the rights of nature, following Halifax, Virginia, Tamaqua, and other Pennsylvania towns. Here's Tom Lindsay.
Tough act to follow. First of all, I'd like to thank the center and Sister Pat and Libby and Margaret and all the folks that helped put this amazing colloquium together. I was joking with Cormac last night. I was saying to him, it's a good thing we get along because we're stuck together for the next 12 days doing a tour of... we get along? from everywhere from the University of Seattle Law School to Pittsburgh Law School this Saturday, and this colloquium is serving as the anchor point for launching off to do that tour, essentially trying to start a new conversation among law schools and law students and faculty about what earth jurisprudence actually means. And in fact, my presentation today is going to be about laying the context of what's happened in Pennsylvania, where we have an interesting situation where municipal governments in the most rural parts of south central and north central Pennsylvania are beginning to pass binding local laws that recognize ecosystems as having rights. That's what's happening in rural Pennsylvania. That work, however, didn't come out of nowhere. And in fact, it's fairly unusual for me to be speaking at law schools, because our work over the past couple of years has taken us mostly into places like bingo halls and church basements and salt sheds, where our municipal officials in Pennsylvania keep the salt that they use to spread on the roads in the wintertime. It's where they meet because they don't have enough money to have real offices. Rural conservative Pennsylvania, south central and north central parts, communities of between 1,000 and 4,000 people in some of the most rural parts of Pennsylvania. We have municipal officials with the steel-toed boots and the John Deere hats, and as a friend of mine from Texas likes to say, belt buckles that would make a Texan proud. So the folks that we have in Pennsylvania that we work with. 90% of our clients at this point are those folks in rural Pennsylvania. And those folks in rural Pennsylvania who we've come to take a liking to over the past 5 or 6 years are, and have been over the last 8 years, taking on the largest agribusiness corporations on the planet, as those agribusiness corporations have attempted to shove large factory hog farms into rural Pennsylvania and unload sewage sludge from treatment plants in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and other urban areas into the rural parts of the state. As you can imagine, in rural Pennsylvania, as with any rural area in the United States, that these folks have been targeted for dumping and projects that nobody else wants. After all, they don't dump 10,000 acres of sewage sludge in suburban Philadelphia. They bring it into the most rural parts of Pennsylvania to do so. We didn't start out, though, in bingo halls and church basements and salt sheds. We actually started out as conventional, traditional environmental lawyers. In fact, in 1995, we had this, what seemed at that point, a very straightforward and simple proposition that we wanted to come out of law school and set up a nonprofit legal defense fund, which we now call the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. It's a firm that I still work for. And we formed the legal defense fund because we had formed a problem statement of our own about the situation that existed with environmental laws in this country. It still blows my mind, but the statistics are still pretty much the same today. There are only 200 full-time public interest environmental lawyers in the United States. 200 full-time public interest lawyers, environmental lawyers in the United States. And the shortage of lawyers, but also the cost of legal assistance. I mean, to hire a lawyer counsel today for a municipal government in Pennsylvania runs anywhere between $250 and $650 an hour. Now, members of the private bar may applaud that, but municipal governments who don't have enough money to buy salt and gravel to take care of their roads don't have necessary amounts of money to hire private attorneys to draft ordinances or do other work for them. And so coming out of law school, we saw a need, and the need was to add two more lawyers to that 200 full-time public interest environmental law bar in the United States. And so we formed the Legal Defense Fund. Legal Defense Fund was tasked in the beginning with providing free legal services to community organizations working on environmental issues. That was our task coming out of law school. And we framed the problem in another way as well, which was not only were there too few lawyers, that's how we framed the problem, too few lawyers. Today we think that there may be too many lawyers doing work in some of these fields, that the problem was enforcement of environmental laws. I came out of Widener Law School in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, being taught by environmental law professors and in other classes that in the United States we have the most vaunted environmental laws in the world. In fact, our environmental laws are so good in the United States that we export our lawyers out to other countries, especially developing countries, to implement structures of law that are similar to our Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act and the vaunted National Environmental Policy Act and other environmental laws that we have in this country. And so at that point, coming out of law school, we defined the problem as not the environmental laws themselves, but the problem was simply the lack of enforcement. And so we put our nose to the grindstone for 4 years. And we began the process of enforcing those environmental laws, whether they were the federal environmental laws or state-based environmental laws. And at one point back in 1996, we had 300 citizen groups that we were representing across the state of Pennsylvania. After all, when you hang a shingle out that says free legal services, your phone tends to ring off the hook, which it did for the first couple of years. And the funny part about, it's tragic actually, about these 300 citizen groups that would come to us for help because they couldn't afford legal counsel otherwise, is that they would come to us and they would say, you know, we're getting a toxic waste incinerator in our community, or there's a plan for a 5,000, 10,000 head hog factory farm, or we're about ready to get hit with Synagro Corporation's 5,000 acres of sludge coming out of treatment plants from a city being dumped in our community. And they would say to us very clearly, they would say, we don't want this toxic waste incinerator in the middle of our community. We don't want this factory farm in the middle of our community. We don't want this thing to transform our community. And I remember very clearly during those years looking back at these citizen organizations and explaining to them very patiently as a conventional environmental lawyer, that the law does not allow you to say no. That's a fairly complicated proposition because people think zoning ordinances or land use laws, they give communities power to say no to things. Well, land use laws are really about separating out incompatible land uses from each other, you know, commercial from residential from industrial. If a use has been deemed a legal use by the state and it gets a permit from the state or the State Department of Environmental Protection, it is a use that a community cannot bar, cannot prohibit. Okay? That's well-settled law. I mean, it's nothing new I'm saying here today. It's well-settled black-letter law. And so these community groups would come to us and they'd say, we want to stop this thing. And we would patiently look back at them and we would say, you can't stop this thing because you have no power under this system of law to stop it because your toxic waste incinerator is a legal use. Department of Environmental Protection has issued a permit. It's a legal use. You as a community can't prohibit it. You can't ban it. But we can help you with something. And we can help you regulate it. We can help you challenge the permit that's been issued from the Department of Environmental Protection. We can engage with you to try to regulate the facility a little bit better in the hopes that if we do it for long enough, that will make it too expensive for the Toxic Waste Incinerator Corporation to come in. Or we'll make it too expensive for the factory farm to site there. And maybe, just maybe, after 8, 10, 12, 14 years of fighting it out in the regulatory system, just maybe you won't get this facility in your community. In effect, looking back on it, we were, in essence, trying to circumvent the defining law, define a niche or an omission or a gap of some sort to actually stop the toxic waste incinerator from coming in because we didn't see it at the time, but the law actually preferenced the corporation's rights over the rights of the community that were attempting to stop the facility from coming in. And so for a couple years there, we lived Groundhog Day. I don't know whether folks have seen the movie Groundhog Day. Bill Murray's in it. He lives the same day over and over and over and over again, and he spends his hours in the next day trying to figure out how to break the cycle. Well, we were in that cycle with these 300 citizen groups, and as good conventional, traditional environmental lawyers, we went to work in the permit appeal area, administrative hearing boards, in front of the Department of Environmental Protection, cases going up to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, two cases going up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And by and large, we were winning. We had a great win-loss record on paper. We would go in front of the administrative hearing boards with a permit application that had been submitted by a corporation, and we would argue on behalf of the citizen group that we were in front of the regulatory agency for, that something was wrong with the permit that had been issued to the corporation to put the toxic waste incinerator in. Everybody that's worked in front of agencies knows how this works. Corporation puts in an application. The environmental reviewer at the agency looks at the application to determine whether it's administratively complete. If it's administratively complete, the permit issues. And then you get into the permit challenge stage. Our job as environmental lawyers coming out of law school was to find the gaps and omissions within the corporate permit application so that we could get the permit application tossed, in other words, revoked, within the administrative forum. We got very good at what we did. We would go in and argue, Your Honor, section little 2, little c, little d, little Roman numeral 3, little c, little 2, little I, which requires a bond to be put onto the corporate application. It wasn't there. $10,000 bond for erosion, sedimentation control plant or something like that wasn't there. And therefore, the permit was issued, shouldn't have been issued, should be overturned. And the judge would look back at us and he'd say, by gosh, you're right. Should have been a $10,000 bond. Only a $2,000 bond was posted. So I'm going to revoke this permit and I'm going to overturn it for you and the citizen organization that had brought the original permit appeal. And when I say Groundhog Day with the movie with Bill Murray in it and what we lived, was we would go back to the house of the leader of the citizen organization, neighborhood group, who had retained us to bring the permit appeal. And we'd have a victory party. And we'd all clap each other on the back, and our citizens group would say, it worked, the system worked. We found a lawyer, we identified a problem, we came together using our First Amendment constitutional rights to assemble, we engaged in this permit appeal process, and the judge agreed with us and he threw the permit out. And so we'd have some snacks and some beer and we'd celebrate with each other about how good the system worked. Well, what would happen 30 or 60 or 90 days later was that the corporation would come back. And this time they'd come back with a new and improved permit application. Remember that $5,000 bond or $10,000 bond that was necessary? Well, we've now posted it. And we fixed all those other problems with the permit application that had been submitted. And now we're ready to move ahead with the project. And the community group would come back to us, and they would say, hey, we need you to do that jujitsu again that you did the first time around, right? To try to beat this permit and get it overturned, because it worked the first time, we've got to do it again. And we would look back at them, and we would say, we're sorry. There's nothing we can do, because now the permit application is administratively complete. And that's what the law requires. 90 days, 120 days after that process occurred, what we would have is the beginning of the construction of a toxic waste incinerator in the middle of the community, or a 5,000-head hog factory farm in the middle of the community. Okay. It reminded me, somebody much smarter than I was at that point, came up with a phrase that I've remembered to this day, which is, the only thing that environmental regulations regulate is environmentalists. Because they make us predictable as to how we oppose projects coming into communities. And what blew my mind even further, as if it needed it at that point in time, was that the corporate boys who were coming in to put the project in over the rights of the communities who were trying to oppose it, that the monies that they would spend to beat back the citizen groups were tax deductible. Tax deductible is reasonable and necessary business expenses under the tax code. So it wasn't even costing them money to fight off the citizen groups that they couldn't recoup because they were recouping it through the tax process. So for us, we said, here we were, the Legal Defense Fund, which was formed to provide free legal services to protect quality of life and natural systems and ecosystems, all this good mom and apple pie kind of stuff. And in essence, we were doing the work of the corporations for them, making better permit applications for the corporations that were coming in. And I didn't know about my colleagues, or I knew about most of them, but that's not the reason why I went to law school, which was to do something much different. And so we decided to close down. We decided to close our doors. of the Legal Defense Fund shut down, because we did one thing we definitely didn't want to do was do the work of the corporate boys for them. It was at that point, 1997, that something very interesting happened, which was the passage of a state law called the Nutrient Management Act in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was the first state to pass something called the Nutrient Management Act, which regulates the amount of liquid manure that can be put on an acre of ground from these huge hog factory farm operations that have been moving into Pennsylvania. I always remember the signing of the bill. You had the environmental group standing behind the governor. You had the agribusiness corporate representative standing behind the governor. It was billed as a win-win situation because Pennsylvania was the first state to deal with excessive amounts of liquid manure from these factory farm operations to be applied to the ground. What those folks behind the governor weren't saying was that the Nutrient Management Act, this statewide law that was put in, contained a preemptive provision in it that preempted all local governments in Pennsylvania from adopting anything more stringent than the state law. Okay? We see it all the time. It's a preemption provision in state legislation that, in essence, prohibits local governments from passing anything more stringent than the state law. What also wasn't explained was that, up to that point in time, 400 local governments in north central and south central Pennsylvania had passed manure management laws specifically to keep the hog factory farms from coming into south central and north central Pennsylvania. This piece of legislation, drafted by two of the four corporations that control 65% of pork production in the United States, was given to the legislators and whisked through and then signed by the governor. And what it did was it canceled out all of those 400 local ordinances across south central and north central Pennsylvania that had kept factory farms out of those areas in the past. It was really our first experience with legislation being written by the corporate folks who were attempting to force something into Pennsylvania to uncork these local governments. Local governments were coming to us because they were being yelled at by their residents to do something about this problem. They were turning to their lawyers at the municipality level, and the lawyers were saying, there's nothing you can do because the state passed this law and you're now preempted from doing anything. They turned to us. We were on our last legs in terms of being a law firm at that point, and we had a choice. We could either counsel the local governments to engage in permit appeals over nutrient management issues, which is what the state law set up in a regulatory format, regulatory field, or we could turn our back on the regulatory system and do something different. And we decided to turn our back on the regulatory system. And we assisted these municipalities to begin passing laws that banned corporations from farming within the municipality. Banned corporations from farming. It was a much different approach. It wasn't a permit approach. It wasn't a regulatory approach. It was a prohibition. It was a prohibition written to circumvent the preemptive laws at the state level. They were corporate ordinances, not activity regulation ordinances, which allowed us to move beyond the preemptive mechanisms and argue that this was a separate set of growing law. 12 municipalities in Pennsylvania passed those laws. 9 states in the Midwest had those books on the laws as well, banning corporations from farming. I mean, just to pause for a moment, we talk about creative law. This was the essence of creative law because these municipalities were left without a remedy. And when folks are faced without a remedy, just like the suffragists were faced, just like the abolitionists were faced, just like people's movements in the past have been faced, they understood the need to create their own remedy within the structure of law. And so these anti-corporate farming laws, as they became known in Pennsylvania, became adopted by these 12 municipalities in 5 counties. Other municipalities came to us asking about sewage sludge. We've had 2 kids die in Pennsylvania after coming into contact with sewage sludge. Sludge is the material that comes out of sewage treatment plants. It can contain up to 600,000 toxic contaminants. The regulatory agencies regulate for 11 of those 600,000 contaminants. There's been sicknesses and death across the United States based on exposure to sewage sludge. Those municipal governments came to us, and we began drafting anti-corporate sludging laws, in essence going after the actors, not simply regulating the activities. Today in Pennsylvania, we have 100 municipal governments. 100 municipal governments out of about 900 municipalities that are rural who have passed our ordinances and local laws, and that's across 15 counties. As you can imagine, when municipal governments believe that they have the gumption to stand up and actually challenge state law by drafting their own and creating these ingenious frameworks of law that in essence switch gears from regulating to defining who's going to determine what agriculture looks like in a particular area, that there's a response. And the response came in from the agribusiness corporations, who used the state legislature to pass a law empowering the Attorney General of the state of Pennsylvania to sue our municipal governments to overturn the ordinances that they had adopted to keep factory farms and sludge out from their municipalities. In addition, the agribusiness corporations used the courts and something called corporate constitutional rights. This concept that we always get asked about, because people say, what do you mean corporate constitutional rights? Corporations have constitutional rights? Absolutely. Corporations are persons under the law. It means that they have Bill of Rights protections. Because of their wealth, they have more rights than you do. And they have more rights in the community when they come in to cite something within that particular community. That they come into the courts and use the courts to try to vindicate their own corporate constitutional rights against these ordinances. What was fascinating was that people in these communities, and there are about 350,000 people in Pennsylvania communities living under the ordinances that we've created and worked with them to adopt, that their problem statement, which in the beginning was, we don't want this toxic waste incinerator because it's very dangerous and it's going to have environmental and health problems. Their problem statement moved from being specifically about environmental issues to being about democracy. Because they started to ask some very difficult questions about why community majorities were being overridden by a small handful of people ensconced within a corporation. And why was the law enabling the corporation to override the rights of the community when we're taught that democratic control is the byword and the undergirding, anchoring piece of our legal system? And so their problem statement shifted from not being just about environmental harms or being about the corporations, but the system of law that was being enforced by the state at the request of the agribusiness corporations to knock down the ordinance structures that have been passed in these 100 different municipalities. And that was an amazing moment in the state, because our townships then and our local governments began to evolve. And the first thing that happened was several local governments began to pass binding ordinances that stripped corporations of constitutional rights at the municipal level. Okay. Talk about being disobedient. U.S. Supreme Court has declared back in the 1880s that corporations are persons. They have, in addition to Bill of Rights protections, they have Interstate Commerce Clause protections and Contracts Clause protections. Here you had municipalities in Pennsylvania who were adopting binding law, not because it was academic. They didn't say, well, you got up on Wednesday morning and let's take on the largest agribusiness corporations in the world. They got up on Wednesday morning and they said, we can't govern ourselves when we're in a system of law in which corporations have more rights than our communities, and when they can use our own governmental institutions to come in and crush us when we attempt to say no or prohibit something from coming into our community that's going to be harmful to our community. In addition to the anti-corporate rights ordinances that began to be passed, people started talking about rights. What's our right to a healthy environment? What's our right to quality of life? What rights can we create and recognize within our municipality that our municipality then has to enforce on our behalf? And it's at that point that we arrived at the rights of nature. Okay. Under our system of law, nature is property. When you own a piece of land, ownership of that piece of land carries with it the authority to destroy it. That's black letter, well-settled law under our system of jurisprudence. Nature is property. What these nature's rights ordinances are about is transitioning nature from being property into being rights-based entities.